Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, tomorrow's midterm budget. Can Treasury balance stability with support for growth? What ferrochrome troubles mean for South Africa's energy-heavy sectors? Compliance culture and work ethics all under increasing pressure. And a new study shows conversation can stop misinformation. It's Tuesday, the 11th of November. Now, it's a big week on South Africa's financial calendar. We head into the November medium-term budget policy statement, or the mini-budget on Wednesday, with, I think, a combination of tighter fiscal discipline and maybe slightly stronger than expected revenue performance. Now, despite a softening economic outlook, tax receipts have surprised on the upside, helped by higher commodity prices, firmer mining royalties. The Treasury, as I understand it, also set to maintain its commitment to consolidation while resisting pressure for tax hikes, even though growth risks do remain elevated. Debt stabilization, reduced borrowing costs, and a more growth-supportive stance, all forming part of a delicate balancing act. All of that is the assessment of Tertia Jacobs, who is Treasury Economist and Fixed Income Specialist at Investec, and joins me now. Tertia, the Treasury, if I've got this right, has managed to hold the line on fiscal consolidation. What do you think has enabled that discipline in what has been a fairly volatile year?
Hi, Jeremy. It's a very good question. I think, you know, the first hurdle that was passed was in the beginning of the year when we had the three budgets, right? And I think the key takeaway there is that the GNU, as well as National Treasury, remains committed to fiscal discipline. So if you want to pass any higher spending measures, it must be financed by some kind of a tax revenue in the absence of, you know, faster growth that's constraining organic growth in revenue receipts. So that came through. And I think that is basically one of the big drivers that Treasury is also getting the departments to adhere to their budgets. They've published the guidelines, so we will see what comes out on Wednesday.
Let me pick you up on tax revenue, which is outperforming expectations. Tertia, is it a commodity story, a compliance story? Is it all about structural shift? What's your assessment?
I think there's a couple of issues. The biggest one is the commodity boom, if I may call it that. It's not as big as it was in 21-22 from the gold and the platinum price. So we think that will probably contribute about 75% to a potential overrun. And I think then the other one is some of the compliance issues where SAR is trying to, you know, enhance its efficiency as well as collecting some of the outstanding undisputed credits. And then I think a third point is also, you know, unfortunately helping, and that is that your VAT refunds are a bit lower in the context of still very weak private sector fixed investment.
A speech like this week is always about optics, and growth expectations have been revised lower. Does that shift maybe, or does that in some way shift the credibility of our medium-term fiscal path, do you think?
That's a very interesting question. I think, you know, the first line where we see this lower GDP growth dynamic playing out is in the composition of tax revenues, which we just discussed, you know. So there has been a bit of a bailout from the commodity side. I do think, you know, looking over the MTEF period, it's going to be very important, you know, what Treasury announces how these higher revenues will be allocated, because, you know, commodity booms tend to be sometimes short-lived. So you can't include that into the baseline forecast. That is the first point. And I think the other issues that we will be looking at is the, you know, reforms on the spending side. That was one of the key takeaways from the GNU, to try and, you know, make do with some of the spending programs that are not working. But I think the bottom line is, Jeremy, what we always come back to is, how can we accelerate the growth trajectory? Because that will make it much easier for everyone if your revenues can just grow faster on the back of stronger demand.
And what kind of message do you think the finance minister needs to send in that respect?
Look, I think he will probably focus on, you know, some of Operation Vulindlela's feedback. Last week we had, or before last week, we had the update for the second quarter. So the takeaway will be there that reforms are happening. But what we do know is that some of the lead times, unfortunately, take a bit longer. So I think his focus will probably be on your point of fiscal consolidation. And then we'll also be looking at, you know, something along the line, what is he going to announce around inflation targets, to sort of back up the governor of the Reserve Bank's focus point on lowering the target to 3%.
If we've got what caused all the difficulty earlier on in the year was the argument about value-added tax. Treasury is resisting a hike. But I guess we've got to ask the question how sustainable that is, given the ongoing spending pressures that we will face in the short to medium term going forward?
I think that is a very important question. So in the baseline forecast for 26-27, Treasury already penciled in another 20 billion of tax increases to counter, you know, the 0.5% of tax that's supposed to go through next year. So I think, you know, with this revenue windfall, at least that reduces the probability that we'll get another type of a tax increase. And unfortunately, what we have seen over the past 2 years is that the higher spending is financed from bracket creep. So that means, you know, the tax burden of the man in the street is actually rising. So, and South Africans are actually highly taxed, right? So we need to approach this differently. And I think it comes back all the more urgency on getting reforms to translate into higher growth.
There's also concern, is there not, about government guarantees that have climbed? I'm thinking particularly around Transnet's facility increase. I mean, that does continue to pose a real fiscal risk, does it not?
Yes. So I think, from example, Moody's noted that, you know, because Treasury gave them another 95 billion of guarantees in this fiscal year, is that, you know, it makes up about 1% of GDP. So it's not going to move the needle that dramatically. But I do think, you know, we will monitor over the next few years whether Transnet is actually going to start moving more or increase its freight, and how it will be, how they will be raising their revenues. So that is a dynamic that's unfolding over the next 3, 4, 5 years.
And just a final one then, if we are going to get a slightly better budget and we're also looking at a deficit projection that has improved, how are the bond markets and the rating agencies going to absorb this?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. You know, I just want to flag here that you get the headline numbers. So what, for example, what you're pointing out is that the main budget deficit and the primary balance will certainly look better because of the expected increase in your revenue receipts. However, when we look at the borrowing requirement, that sometimes tells a bit of a different story, because government has to raise a certain amount of cash. For example, you know, Eskom, I think, received this year also, my number's a bit off, but about 50 billion rand or so. So there has been assistance from the JAFACRA that Treasury will be drawing on again, which is 25 billion rand this year. So they've also pre-funded because there's a big redemption of about 98 billion in December. So depending then on the revenue projections and the cash balances, there may be a small chance that they can reduce bond supply. But I think our base case is that they will wait and see until February, you know, to actually pocket the tax revenues from the mines.
Tertia Jacobs, thank you very much indeed. Treasury economist, fixed income specialist at Investec. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Samancor Chrome's announcement that it may shut down its ferrochrome operations, I think it's fair to say, has shaken South Africa's industrial sector. The move, I think, highlights the escalating strain on energy-intensive sectors, obviously squeezed by soaring power costs, logistics, which in many respects are unreliable, and also volatile global prices. Now, if confirmed, the shutdown could affect thousands of jobs. It's going to send out a real message about South Africa's manufacturing competitiveness. So let's discuss the legal, economic, and social implications. I'm in conversation now with Lucinda Hinksman, who's head of employment and labor at the law firm CMS South Africa. Lucinda, welcome. And maybe let's start with what we know. What exactly has Samancor announced? And why are analysts calling this the final flicker for the ferrochrome industry?
It is quite a significant announcement, so to speak, in that what Samancor have put out there is that there is a possibility that they might be closing down their smelter operations. There has been quite a significant shutdown over a period of time of the smelters for ferrochrome across our country. Many of them have been mothballed, and as I understand, I think these are the last two in operation. And this has more been a warning that Samancor have issued, and I think Glencore also issued a similar warning last month or month or two ago, that the electricity prices and the import costs of other goods are impacting them significantly. And therefore, if this happens, they will have to embark on a large-scale redundancy process, as well as cease operations in terms of smelting ferrochrome.
Let me ask you this then. High electricity costs, also, I think, transport bottlenecks are being blamed for the crisis. From a legal economic view then, from where you sit, do those justify closure under current labor regulations?
They do, unfortunately. And it'll be quite sad if those are the reasons as to why they are forced to go into a retrenchment process, because it will link to their operational requirements. They will basically be able to lawfully rely on the ground that they simply cannot operate with the costs that they currently have and the financial crisis that the business is in.
So legally speaking then, if a company of this size shuts down, what does the process require? And maybe just outline for us what kind of safeguards, if any, exist for affected workers and staff.
So the process would in essence be a large-scale retrenchment process. It's in terms of Section 189A of the Labour Relations Act, and it's a consultation process. They would be able to refer it to facilitation by the CCMA, or not facilitate, that is the more contentious side of things. But if they facilitate, it allows the CCMA to intervene, and they will facilitate the whole process in terms of how the consultations unfold. The unions, of course, will be invited to consult, and they'll go through the various topics, such as the rationale behind it, whether there are any alternatives to retrenchment. Of course, that will be the key factor here. And it certainly was the key factor from an ArcelorMittal perspective when they were in a similar situation. And then the process will slowly unfold over a period of 60 days if they go the facilitated route. So the safeguards for employees really are it's the consultation process. It's for them to be fairly represented in that process and to ensure that all alternatives are exhausted. And this really is the last hope of saving the business or not at all, is that they've got no alternative but to retrench. If that's the case, then of course the conversation turns to money, and that's around severance pay. So affected employees will, at a minimum in terms of the basic conditions, get at least 1 week of pay for each completed year of service. However, there may be collective agreements in place that entitle them to something more, or the social and labour plan may provide for something else.
And conventional wisdom, I think, would suggest that there are very few alternatives on the table, so it will probably move straight to step two.
Absolutely. I think we've seen it play out most recently with what I just mentioned with ArcelorMittal, in that, IDC did bail them out to a certain degree with a facility of just over a billion. I think they blew through that quite quickly, understandably, given again the costs. And so any bailout is going to, again, just if it happens, it's just going to be kicking the can down the road. So I think it's one of those that unless they can get those guaranteed reduced tariffs, perhaps that might buy them some more time, but it would really need to see whether that really comes to fruition and how extensive the reduction in tariffs really is.
And Lucinda, there's also a domino effect because a large-scale industrial exit like this, I imagine, ripples through the entire supply chain as well as surrounding communities.
Absolutely. From an employment perspective, the impact is immense. I remember some years ago, I think there was a survey done where they found that one employed person fed 10 people. And so if you are talking about, just retrenching, let's say 1,000, we've got 10,000 people going hungry, who no longer have an income. And generally, with these sorts of operations in any mining industry, it's really community-based. And so you're affecting high populations of individuals in concentrated areas, which it does, from that perspective, it's devastating. Of course, then we look at the operational effect, which impacts our economy. Again, we have a high unemployment rate, but also we now are going to rely on having to export everything that they mine.
And just a quick one in conclusion, there is precedent, is there not, for governments to step in to stabilize industries like this before total collapse, is there not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's really what Samancor and Glencore are trying to appeal for, is that the government needs to step in if they want this industry to be saved, if they want to keep the economics going here of what it generates for the country, both from an employee perspective but also from an operational perspective. They need to intervene. They need to intervene now.
Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Lucinda Hinksman, who is Head of Employment and Labour Law at the law firm CMS South Africa. Lucinda, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's workforce is getting younger and more demanding. By 2030, Gen Z is going to make up nearly 40% of the labour market, with most juggling multiple income streams. They value flexibility, mental health, and purpose. And that mindset, I think, is forcing companies to rethink how they govern and manage risk. Muhammad Ali, who's managing director of the consulting firm WWISE, says businesses that cling to old school, what he terms paper-heavy compliance systems, are simply going to be left behind. And the future, he says, lies in agile, digital and values-driven governance. All well and good, but how do you actually get there if you're running a business? Muhammad, a very warm welcome to you. Let's begin maybe with the headline shift, if we can. What makes Gen Z's approach to work so different from previous generations? What have you discerned?
I think what's been interesting with this Gen Z is their exposure to different mediums of social media, from TikTok to Meta to WhatsApp. And I think the instant gratification that's being sold from very good marketing, influencers, is what they are more alluding towards. So I think COVID-19 had a lot to do with working from home and being able to earn multiple income streams. So I think the driving factor of Gen Z's is they want to become rich very quickly, and they want to have a good life very quickly, as opposed to the millennials or the generation before, where you need to grow into your particular role and you need to prove yourself to be where it is, where the Gen Z's are more on instant gratification. There is a pro and there is obviously cons to both sides of the coin. And working with a lot of Gen Zs, they do ask a lot of questions, which I think is good, provided that you yourself are competent and have the ability to guide them in the right direction and give them the right answers so that they can be able to have clarity. In the previous generations, what you were asked to do something and you would go ahead and do it without asking too many questions. And I think that's been a little bit of a shift. The biggest challenge is having these two generations working together to be able to work in a unified way, to be able to achieve a common goal and objective. And I think there is place for that, because you've got people that know the law, that have experience, that know legislation, know conformity, know standards, know company policies, cultures, etc., values. And then you've got the young generation that comes with a lot of technology in terms of figuring out how to do things much more smarter than harder, using tools such as AI or generative AI, et cetera, as well as workflow management, and combining those together, provided that they understand and respect one another, can work in the right direction. However, the problem in the corporate world is they don't see eye to eye. Either the elder generation is more threatened by the younger ones, and the younger ones are not happy to work with the older ones because they feel right. They're a bit too outdated. And that's where the issues are, I think.
It's beyond an issue. I think it's a real generational clash that's emerged, or is in fact happening, between senior managers who, as you've said to me, are steeped in hierarchy, and the younger staff who have a different approach and perhaps expect a lot more autonomy. So how then do you navigate a consensual path to make sure that both parties in that equation are appeased and it leads to productivity and profitability?
So I think what's important, like what I do generally, is I look for case studies that allude to similar situations on how these common goals and objectives have been fulfilled between the two generations. So in your company, you could have multiple generations. You can have baby boomers, you can have the millennials, you can have the Gen Y, the Gen Z. Now you'll see the Gen Alpha also coming in. So all these different generations that are coming in, I always allude to what case studies they see. And what I've seen in South Africa, there's a standard called the South African National Standard 1601, Health and Wellness. And there's an international standard called 45003. And this 45003 is more around the occupational health and safety, but it's guidelines on being able to create a productive work environment by addressing factors such as workload, lack of control, bullying, work-life balance, which is a key component of Gen Z. Now, if you implement the standard where you get both sides of the generations to speak their mind and come with a common policy that works for the organization and works for both generations, to extract the productivity that they can best provide, whether it's working from home or having the flexibility or flexi time or coming to work and working the hours, and you come up with a balance. If you strike that balance, and as a business owner or the C-suite or the board members allow that opportunity, I think you will gain towards the productivity level. But if you are still trying to fight and are biased towards one side or the other, you are facing a case of disaster where the culture can become toxic and can bring the entire organization down. So my common goal would be to go towards those standards to guide us in the right direction.
It's all very well, though, having those standards, but often the older generation of managers will find them very difficult to implement, because they also are under a lot of pressure, surely from shareholders, for instance, who are expecting a certain performance to emerge from the company.
Yeah, and I think they need to understand that succession planning and business continuity is imperative. It's one of the downfalls we've actually had in South Africa. We've got a lot of experienced people that unfortunately have left the country or retired. And all that knowledge, wealth of knowledge, has never been surpassed down. And I think it's very important for the younger generation to respect the older, to get that information, and the older generation to be able to hand that down. If you have a correct succession planning with the aim of benefiting the organization, I think it could work. I agree. A lot of people do not want a cumbersome management system. Mm. But what the solution is you will see that, you know, things can work smarter, not harder. And what do I mean by that? I mean, in my days, I remember very clearly when my dad asked me to find a plumber or an electrician, I would go to the yellow pages.
Yeah.
And now today, you'll see it's gone to Google. And technology is advanced, provided you understand the experience. And a lot of the older generation that I've worked with, when they see the value, or rather experience the value of minimizing administrative burden by automating mundane repetitive tasks, they sort of buy in. It takes a long time for them to buy in, but if they have the zeal to be able to learn and grow, I think we can be able to work with the two generations and be able to use their experience to adaptively work with reducing the burden of policies. Nowadays, you know, don't look at policies in writing. The younger generation of Gen Zs would perhaps go to a video or generative AI to understand what the policy is for the organization, as opposed to going to a document, searching for it, and reading it, as what the older generation would do. So if you combine those two modes of thought and technology together, trust me, I think we can go in the right direction. And that's what the standard promulgates in terms of working with technology and working with the generation.
I remember with a great deal of fondness that Yellow Pages arriving with a thunk on the doorstep. Muhammad Ali, thank you very much indeed. Managing Director at the consultancy WWISE. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
In this hyper-connected world, I don't need to tell you that false news can spread faster than truth, and particularly during an election, it becomes a real threat to democracy. Now, a South African NPO, it's called Tales of Turning, has released new research showing that simple online dialogue can dramatically slow misinformation. I want to explore this in a little more detail with Stefan Nell from Tales of Turning. Stefan, a very warm welcome to you. In one sentence then, why does this intervention, simple online dialogue, actually work when so many other interventions fail?
So what it does is it effectively it gets people to reflect on what they would otherwise emotionally either like or post or reshare. It's a simple mechanism. When we look at a post or online, we respond, our first response is emotive, and it's in that emotive, that little fraction of emotivity, if there is a question, then placed behind that question, behind that post.
The trouble is society these days, Stefan, doesn't really have the luxury of time or even the inclination, though, to reflect, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't. But this prompts them to do that. And it doesn't just work in elections, it works in all narratives. So in whatever narrative you're looking at online, whoever's interested and concerned about that narrative can play a role in calming and preventing the spread of dis and misinformation in a particular narrative. So it's not just elections, it works for gender-based violence, xenophobia, many other of the social ills that we deal with.
So how does the method actually work then?
So the method is, it's called social truth questioning, and what it queries, and what it does is it posts a question after somebody has made a statement that is likely disinformation or hate speech related. That the effect of that question is what reduced the spread of disinformation by 82%.
Why do you think that humans or the human touch then beats an algorithm in this space?
Well, it doesn't beat an algorithm, but what it does is it humanizes the interaction. The thing on social media, there's this 1:9:90 ratio in social media. Just very briefly, 1% of social media make the noise, 9% of social media interact with that noise, and 90% of social media observe. So what we do is we look for allies in the in whatever narrative is online, people who are speaking out in against, for argument's sake, gender-based violence. And then those allies, we put them in what we call a behavioral reinforcement program, which is a process of encouraging them to do what they have already shown that they are doing online and what they're opposed to. And that farms the 90%. So there are many, many more good actors on social media than there are bad actors. And we only see the noise from the bad actors. That's how it works.
How scalable is a method like this? Could it, for instance, run across a national election in a big country like the United States or even India, for that matter?
Well, so there is, of course, we're exploring AI as a possibility in this. There's a really strong possibility that AI could generate the initial truth questioning, but our purpose is to deepen the conversation online. So from a Tales of Turning perspective, we look at what's happening on social media. We don't have purchase over the algorithms, over the platforms, or for that matter, the kind of legislative framework that would be required to affect the kind of rules that they are producing in the US and other places. So our focus has been really on the users or people online, and how can they play a role in taking charge of the space that they are in. And I think that a combination of both AI and this deepening the conversation, which is another part, we use a number of methodologies, and this is one of the methodologies. What it does is it gives us the opportunity to deepen conversations where people are projecting their unhappiness online.
How do you prevent your method, though, from becoming part of the noise or even being dragged into the online conflict that you're trying to prevent in the first place?
So the first thing, we started doing this in experimenting in this field in 2020, and we started with xenophobia, which is a really interesting field because it's very reactive. We quickly learned that people who are angry online, they need to be heard. That's partially why they are projecting like that. And it's to engage them in a way that is not provocative, to engage them in a way that is that gets them to reflect. So what happens is you can't get rid of the original post. And of course, many of those posts are generated by bots as well. The effect of both bots and human generated posts, that's what it does. It reduces it by 82%. We've done research on this for years, and we're very, very pleased that we now have evidence to back it.
So what then do you think the biggest barrier is to getting platforms to integrate your approach?
Well, platforms don't have to integrate it. And the thing is that people migrate from platform to platform. So the approach applies to all the platforms. Effectively, wherever you find yourself in social media, you can apply this methodology to whatever cause you're aligned to. The interesting thing about it is that it's agnostic in that it doesn't produce a particular outcome. All it produces, if you are opposed to reflection, then you're opposed to what we're doing. It can't be used to promote a particular ideal or idea. It really is around getting people online to think more in the most gentle way about what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, the key word there obviously is reflection. It's become so important in this hurly-burly nature of social media. Fascinating stuff. Stefan Snell, thank you very much indeed from the NPO Tales of Turning. I appreciate your time today. And on that note, we are going to say goodbye. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.